TurboTax helps you do your taxes with confidence and ease with awesome tools that make uploading your W-2 as easy as taking a picture. Just use your phone or tablet to snap a picture of your W-2 to get a head start on your taxes. You can be sure you're filing your taxes correctly while at the same time getting your best possible refund. TurboTax. All people are tax people.
Hey everybody, welcome back to From Complex to Queens, a Mason Avenue's minor league podcast. I am Steve Seifer, and I'm joined this week by Ken Lavin and Thomas Henderson. Lucas, unfortunately, is busy doing science, so he will not be able to join us this week. But science is a really good thing, so. Do you guys actually know what he does? I don't really remember.
Bioengineering, I think. Biological engineering. I'm not positive. Smart things.
Yeah, I know.
Super smart things.
He does a science.
All right. Well, we'll start off with promote, extend, trade. And this week, well, this date, I should say, all the way back in 1258. So we're going back quite a bit. The caliph of the Abbasid Empire, he surrendered Baghdad to the Mongols, and that effectively ended their empire. Because the Mongols sacked it, the city of Baghdad, to like a level historians still can't accurately like say how many died and really comprehend. But that, you know, set the world back a lot intellectually and scientifically and technology, because the Abbasid Empire was like really advanced, something that kind of doesn't get discussed much here, you know, in the U.S. unless it's kind of something that you're specifically studying. But yeah, the Abbasid Caliphate was pretty big and pretty advanced. It stretched all the way from northern Africa to the Arabian Peninsula to Mesopotamia. So that's like millions of square miles with a bunch of different cultures and stuff going on. So what are we going to promote, extend, or trade of these dessert foods that can be found in those regions today? So first we got baklava, next we have halva, and last but certainly not least are probably the freshest, most rich, juicy fruits that you'll probably find anywhere else in the entire world. Talking oranges, really, really good citrus stuff. Really good fruit. So what are we keeping and what are we getting rid of?
Probably promoting the fruit.
Same.
You could do a lot of different things with that.
Very good point. I feel like the hard part is not figuring out what we like and what we really like, but the hardest part is just figuring out what to get rid of.
Yeah.
Can you hit me with the choices again, Steve?
We got baklava, we got halva, and then the fruits.
What exactly is halva?
Halva is like a sesame-based sweet. It's really good.
I think I'm going to promote baklava because I've had it before and trade the other one simply because I don't know what it is.
Yeah.
Fair.
Yeah, I'm about the same thing because I've had baklava before.
Big fan. Never had, can confirm.
Never had halva, either one of you guys?
Nope. No.
Oh, it's so good. I want to say the company is called Joyva or J-O-Y something. It's the factory and everything headquarters is in Brooklyn. They're like the world's biggest, which is kind of funny because it's like a Middle Eastern, you know, delicacy or dessert, whatever you want to call it. But they're the world's largest, manufacturers of it. But yeah, if you're ever in like, I don't know, place that, I know the shop right by my house has it in like the kind of, it's not frozen, but well, the refrigerated, like their ethnic refrigerated section. But yeah, if you've never had it, then definitely have some because it's just really, really good. All right. So this is going to be the last week that we're going to be discussing our top 25 lists for 2020. So just to recap, I love the sound of my own voice here. So we're going to go over the top 25 one last time. So number 25 is Alexander Ramirez. 24 is Jake Mangum. 23 is Ali Sanchez. 22 is Stanley Consuegra. 21 is Daniel Nunez. 20 is Adrian Hernandez. 19 is Riley Gilliam. 18 is Dyson Acosta. 17 is Tony DeBrell. 16 is Jalen Palmer. 15 is Freddy Valdez. 14 is Junior Santos. 13 is Harold Gonzalez. 12 is Kevin Smith. 11 is Joshua Wolf. 10 is Shervian Newton. 9 is Franklin Killame. 8 is Thomas Zupucki. 7 is David Peterson. 6 is Francisco Alvarez. 5 is Mark Vientos. 4 is Brett Beatty. 3 is Matthew Allen. 2 is Andres Jimenez. And 1 is Ronnie Mauricio. Now, I read the comments section. I'm probably in the minority on our site since I like the comments and I think they're, you know, kind of one of the most important parts of the site because, you know, a lot of good baseball discussion can be found there. But I've noticed a few comments along the lines of, like, Ronnie Mauricio shouldn't be the top prospect, or conversely, at the bottom of the list, you know, Ali Sanchez or Jake Mangum or whoever, they shouldn't be on a top 25 list at all. So what I want to do this week is talk about what goes into making a prospect list. What goes into evaluating your prospects and then kind of ordering them. Everybody has different criteria. They weigh things a little differently, whatever else. So for everybody, it's going to be a little different, but generally speaking, not only just on Amazing Avenue itself, but at other, baseball outlets, you kind of see, you know, patterns. It's not like Amazing Avenue has, Antoine Duplantis as the number one prospect. And, you know, Ronnie Mauricio is not even on the list. You know, no offense to Antoine Duplantis, but just, you know, you don't see things that are kind of radical and crazy. There generally is a consensus among people that, you know, speak with each other like us, or even places where, you know, we don't speak with the people at all, and they are, you know, national guys that look down on us peons, whatever. But for me, and I think all of you guys, since Lucas is not here, the most important thing is stuff.
Yeah, I'll agree with that.
Yeah.
Yeah, so
I think that's got Allen as high as he is on our list for literally that reason. Just point to him.
It is good stuff. Now, when you're talking about stuff, I think that there's are two different ways to measure it. First person looks and then industry kind of sources. So for first person looks, obviously it's, you know, you yourself go to a game and you watch the game with this kind of stuff in mind. You know, you watch a player and, you know, is he speedy? If you have access to a clock, you know, you're going to time him. If you have access to a radar, you're going to, you know, see how fast a pitcher is throwing. If you're, you know, know what you're looking for, you're going to watch the catcher and how is he handling things. You know, you're going to watch the outfielders. Do they good jumps? Do the infielders have range? You know, all kinds of things. I'm lucky enough, I guess, this year, well, not this year, this past season, to have gone to ton of games. I saw Binghamton and Brooklyn, and I got an entire homestand in Columbia and Kingsport. And obviously, you're not going to get a better sense of a player than seeing them yourselves. An example, you know, coming into the coming into the season, the 2019 season, reports about Francisco Alvarez were that the defense needed some work. And then when I saw him, clearly the work had been done because he looked really good behind the plate. You know, the arm was solid, accurate, and he was pretty mobile, animated back there. So if we were still going by those 2018 reports, you know, it's paints a very different picture than the Alvarez that played last season. Another example, Junior Santos. Initially, the reports were that the fastball could touch, you know, 94, and that he was, you know, a big kid, but not as big as he actually was. And when I saw him down there, my gun had him sitting 94, 95, topping out like 97. And the guys charting him, sitting next to me, their gun was reaching 99. So, I mean, regardless of whichever one is more accurate, that's a guy being on a very different level, you know, topping out 97 and 99 instead of 94. You know, it makes a pretty big difference as a prospect. Another guy, you know, tops out close to triple digits, Michael Altañez. You'd think he'd be a guy, as Ken can attest, though, he's, you know, really not right now because
there's not much else
in person.
Yeah. Yep. It's like, yeah, it's really great. He throws really hard, but, you know, it only matters if you can locate, you know. Yeah. And that's something you'd only be able to tell, like, in person seeing it happen, you know.
And I think this works in the other ways, too, with, like, Jimenez, where going on a Jimenez look from 2018, he's clearly the top prospect in the system. But that wasn't the case last year because of multiple reasons. So it goes both ways.
And that's where the next part, you know, where the next place you're going to get reports of stuff, that's where, you know, this kind of is a drawback now from industry sources. That kind of touch and go. You know, industry sources, I'm talking about scouts, beat writers, other prospect writers, newspapers, and other kind of non-baseball specific reporters, stuff like that. You kind of need to determine for yourself who and what is reputable and who or what isn't. And I don't mean reputable like there's dishonest actors out there.
A lot of information is flying around from...
Right. Exactly.
Like anything you read, there's bias, you know?
Exactly. And people who think that they're reporting honestly maybe don't have the most accurate information. And Jimenez is an excellent example. If you go to Baseball America or Fangraphs or MLB Prospect Pipeline, not to call those guys out or anything like that, but nothing mentions the fact that his swing was tweaked or changed. And I remember I was at a game in Bingo and I got a text from either Jeffrey or Jarrett from Baseball Prospectus and, you know, that they were at the game. And I, you know, went over and I was sitting with them and Jarrett, I think it was, noticed that the swing had a lot more plane. And we looked at older videos and lo and behold, it does. And, you know, you'll not going to find that at outlets that don't necessarily have guys with eyes on the ground getting kind of up-to-the-date information. A lot of these national sources, you know, they're big operations, but they kind of rely more on just contacts rather than firsthand reports. And those firsthand reports are always going to be more accurate than just kind of relying on what, you know, your anonymous scout, you know, not friends, but your anonymous scout source that you need to find out information about the Mets guys. Seeing these players, you know, and getting the most up-to-date information about them is going to yield better results than just kind of relying on people to tell you about these guys.
No, yeah, for sure. I think that's where baseball is pretty interesting, where, like, it's a sport that's going in such a analytical direction and such a numbers-based direction, but for prospect scouting, like, you really need to see it. Like, it's so different than what's going on in the major league level, I think, where, like, I can kind of look at a major league player's Fangraphs page and figure out if I think they will be good next year, without really having to see that player. So it always strikes me as interesting, looking at it differently from prospects and already major league players.
There's just so much more noise in all of the statistics below the major league level that, you know, firsthand context becomes more important.
Oh, for sure, yeah.
Mm-hmm. I mean, maybe one day, I think it's probably a pipe dream. It'll never happen because this kind of stuff will always be fiercely guarded and protected by teams because it'll obviously give them, you know, a leg up over the competition. But maybe one day there will be a way to kind of use analytics to more accurately identify, you know, certain things about prospects. You could have one day TrackMan data available at every stadium, you know, in the future, maybe something even more advanced, tracking more accurately, you know, the flight of a pitcher's path or, you know, swing minutia that, you know, video might pick up that, you know, is not picked up now, whatever. But definitely for the time being, it is, yeah, kind of an old prospect stuff is definitely in a kind of old school thing where the eyes matter more than what the numbers say. But that doesn't mean that numbers don't matter at all. You just kind of have to weigh them and kind of look at them with the context. Obviously, you want your player to do good rather than bad, but, you know, it really below low A, the numbers don't really matter at all. You know, at low A, high A, it's kind of questionable. Really, it's like only double A and triple A that you could really start making a strong correlation between like the numbers and possible MLB projection in the future. But I think that the more important stuff than the actual pure numbers, the most important things anyway, are a player's age in relation to the level and the numbers that they're putting up, any trends that pop up, and any splits that might pop up. Do you guys agree, disagree? Think that there's anything else?
I agree, especially on age. I think that goes under the radar a lot, especially with the younger kids, like being 18 and being 3 years younger than everyone, at, like the average age of everyone else. That's a big deal at the time that you don't really think about. And for someone to just be like average against people that much older than them at that age is hard. So for me, age is always something that I look at. I'm always looking at that to see, to make sure if, to kind of put everything in context, I mean.
Yeah, age relative to competition is also something that I believe in, at least for prospects. Like, and it's not always the case, you know?
Sure.
But like, I particularly get pumped when a player is, you know, really young and performing against older competition. Like, that bodes well generally.
Yeah.
Definitely.
It's one of those things where, like, if you see it, it's good, and if it's not there, it's like, well, you don't have to kind of, like, lose your hype on the prospect because of it. So it's kind of like a thing that you – it's like an icing on the cake type of thing, almost, I guess is a good way to put it.
Yeah, like, we always want to see them do good, so if they do good, exactly, icing on the cake. But if they don't, you know, it is whatever because context.
Yeah.
Trends are an important thing. I think Ronny Mauricio's first half and second half, they aren't radically different, but he hit a lot better. He hit almost 300 in the first half. And then he kind of, I'm not going to say spiraled out of control, but he hit a lot less than almost 300 in the second half.
I mean, he ended hitting 260. So
right.
Like, that's a big drop off.
Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's you can't just look at you can't just look at the overall batting line and say, okay, XYZ, because he was really good in the first half, and now we'll talk about age in relation to level. He's a young kid. He's never played so many games before. Clearly, he tired. And then the second half data, you know, it shows that, you know, he was a lot worse. So splits, another, you know, related kind of thing that you need to be aware of when you're looking at the numbers. Take a guy like Kevin Smith, that there was a lot of divergence of thought, I think is a nice way of putting it. So,
yeah. I mean,
you know,
I don't even know how to feel about him on my own, in my own analysis of him, to be honest, because the statistics don't lie, but then you watch him and it's like, okay. I don't really know
which
how you did that.
Which brings you to the other thing there, which is that, you know, stuff can work at lower levels that won't work up the ladder. So, you know, Kevin Smith can throw his, you know, pretty good slider and get a disproportionate amount of swings and misses in double A, but is that going to project forward, you know?
Yep. And that is why I think he was such a very divisive guy, is because people are looking at just the numbers and not really taking into consideration too much else. And when you do look at the other stuff, then he's a very different kind of prospect than he is if you just look at the numbers and the ERA and whatever else.
Yeah, by the numbers, he's one of the best prospects in the system. Because he was, dominant, you know? If you're just looking at stuff like that, you're not doing yourself a disservice.
Yep, very true. All right, do you guys think that there's anything else that kind of goes into this? I mean, again, when you have all this information in front of you and you're applying it towards a particular player and then you kind of arrive at where you want to place them on your list. You know, that each person does it differently. Each person has their own biases and they'll put more an emphasis on one thing or, you know, won't consider another thing as much as something else, whatever the case may be. But that generally is the nuts and bolts. You guys think anything else goes into it that I'm kind of missing?
I mean, like upside versus floor. Everybody kind of falls in a different part of that, you know, where those intersect for you.
Yeah.
I tried to be a lot higher on upside guys this year than last year. I don't know.
I mean, it's easy to get caught up in the upside.
Oh, yeah, no.
And that's the fun part, and that's, what you want to see. You want to see the upside. Like, when we were talking about David Peterson, we were like, he's a boring dude, and that's, not necessarily a bad thing for his future career, but it's also, it's hard for me to, pound the table for that, too, because it's just a floor. He's a total floor play, and some dudes are like that, and that's fine.
And it's good to have a mix of those guys, but, you know, the guys that really get me excited are ones that, you know, have the potential to be impact talent, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what kind of makes this system a little more difficult to maybe, you know, put in any kind of order or maybe tier, whatever, however you want to look at it. Because there's so many guys that are at a lower level that you're kind of just looking at the upside, that it's almost like they're mirages. You know, you're just kind of looking at them, thinking best case scenario, and that's kind of color your thoughts of them. And in a system like this where there's just so many guys like that, you know, by and large, the entire system is made up of guys like that. It makes it kind of a little more difficult to then compare to the guys that are higher up in the system and have more experience, but maybe aren't as flashy. It's funny because I remember a couple of years back when we were doing this, when the system was in no order, because I don't remember the exact order of these guys, but when the top prospects in the system were, you know, Travis d'Arnaud, Noah Syndergaard, Rafael Montero, Dilson Herrera, Michael Conforto, Brandon Nimmo. Like, you had such a stacked, 1 to 10 almost, that we didn't even really have to consider guys, at the bottom. I know my own personal, not rule or whatever, but, I never really ever considered guys below single A. And now it's
it's completely impossible.
They barely have anybody above single A, exactly. Yeah. So
have to make the whole prospect list out of below single A.
Pretty much.
Like it's to the point where a dude hits like 500 in a week of like GCL ball, and we're like, oh, is that a top prospect? Because like, there's not what else are you supposed to get excited about here? Which is, it's just crazy because this also, with how young these kids are, like in 4 years, we could be having the same conversation where it's like, oh, double A is stacked now. Like, triple A is like, there's all these kids knocking on the door that if they work out, and if they don't work out, then we're right back to where we are now, where everyone that we care about is super young and super, we don't, like, a question mark.
Yep, these things are very cyclical, so hopefully, you know, nobody is traded.
Hopefully this round's version of, you know, the 4 or 5 kids in the Sally League for the first time ends up going pretty well.
Yeah, that's...
So it's like another relatively nice crop of people about to tackle, like, full season bowl for the first time.
Gonna be a sack team in Columbia again, but that is literally what we said last year, and, you know, didn't turn out too great, so...
Okay.
All right, well, let's take a break here, and we'll be right back after this.
There's a new kind of credit card created by Apple. It's called Apple Card, and it lives in your wallet app and in your wallet. You can buy things with Apple Pay or a laser-etched titanium card. It sets a whole new level for privacy and security. And it gives you daily cash back with every purchase. Oh, and you can apply in minutes. Just open the wallet app on your iPhone and tap the plus button to get started. To learn more, check out apple.co/getAppleCard. Available for qualifying applicants in the United States. Issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch.
Welcome back to From Complex to Queens. I'm Steve Saipa, and I'm joined by Ken Levin and Thomas Henderson. And we're just kind of wrapping up our 2020 prospect coverage for the year. So I published at this point, maybe 2 weeks ago, how, you know, we each voted for, you know, the top 25 guys and how everything worked out. So it is a little difficult to just kind of say each guy, each one of us, and how we voted. It's kind of a thing that you need to look at. So I'll just kind of look over the lists, and anything that stands out, you know, can just kind of talk about. First one, I guess I'll mention is Francisco Alvarez. And surprisingly to me, because, you know, we did these lists all the way back in like November, so I kind of did forget how everybody, you know, actually voted until I had to look at it and publish it. But surprisingly, I was the high person on Alvarez, and I figured Ken would have been.
That's kind of the one I want back. I don't think I could get him to 2 just because Jimenez is so close to the big leagues. But I do kind of – I would flip in hindsight Allen and Alvarez.
Yeah, so I voted Alvarez 2. Lucas voted him 6. Ken, you had him 5. And Thomas, you had him 3. Oh, excuse me. You had him 4, Ken. But, yeah, that surprised me a little bit. Let's see.
I think 2 through 5 are pretty much, or 2 through 4 at least, are pretty much interchangeable anyway.
Yeah, I mean, like we were saying earlier, sometimes it's easier to conceptualize all these guys in like tiers rather than actual numbers. And yeah, the let's say 1 to 5 or 6, whatever, are, it's definitely like the top tier, and there's different variations more or less, but it's all the same names.
Yeah, it's hard to sneak anyone else into that group.
Yeah. Let's see. Everybody else voted Brett Baty over Mark Vientos. I was the only one to have Vientos over Baty. But
that's a little one of those calls that I think they're more or less the same player, just at different points.
Pretty much everybody has them one after the other, so.
Yeah, that's like, at least for me, it's a little bit of a shiny new toy thing. And also, like, Vientos is a little bit closer for me to being like, I don't know if he could actually hit. But, like, he has to start hitting. And Baty has more of an upside. Not more of an upside, but, like,
We haven't seen him struggle in full season bowl yet.
Yeah, exactly.
Let's see. Lucas voted Joshua Smith all the way at 17. I wish he was here. Although if I looked on his profile thing, we'd probably get a glimpse into his mindset. But that is definitely a lot lower than everyone else. I thought I was going to be the low guy on him, and I had him at 14. But I was clearly not. Ken, you had him at 10. And
Thomas at 9.
Thomas at 9, like. Yeah.
I like prep pitchers. They burn out a lot, but there's upside. And I especially like that there's projection with Wolf. There isn't projection with a lot of guys in this system.
Yeah, that and like even though I'm not in love with his mechanics, which is something that for pitchers like I care about a lot. I like to see like, bad mechanics kind of scare me off a little bit, but like I don't really can't think of many other people who has the ceiling that Wolf does in the system. So that's why I was higher on him than everyone else.
Definitely is a guy to, you know, if you want to get behind, he's a guy that you can get behind.
Again, not too different from SWR at all.
No, he's a kind of more projectable Simeon Woods Richardson. I vaguely remember at some point in the comment, I guess it was in Wolf's, on Wolf's page, someone in the comments was talking about how can you say with any kind of certainty, how can you project with any kind of certainty, you know, an 18-year-old kid say that he is going to grow more or is not going to grow more, whatever, when talking about the comparison between the two. And, yeah, that's just something that, you know, you kind of have to – if you have a hunch, you know, you don't, whatever, but that's how – that is how you – say with any kind of certainty, you know, Simeon Woods Richardson, he's 6'2", 6'3", whatever it is, but he's a kind of not thick, not fat.
He's already very strong.
Right. He doesn't look like, unless he physically grows more and goes from 6'2" to whatever else, he's probably not going to fill in more without getting at like a bad weight.
And there's already a lot of effort in the delivery. So there's a lot of effort, and he's already extremely strong to get to 91 to 94.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's what was the worrying part for me about him.
Whereas
I always felt like he should have thrown
a stick figure.
Yes.
And yes, the mechanics are high effort, but you can really imagine him filling in a little bit because most guys his size are not stick figures when they're 22, 23.
Yeah.
Now, it doesn't mean that he is going to fill in.
Right,
he might
right.
not.
But that's, but,
you know. That's why these are projections.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Let's see. So what else? I did not have Jordan Humphreys on my list at all. And I'm just, was never really that big of a fan, even before the surgery. And now that he's had the surgery and he's come back and everything, you know, we need to see another year of him to get the rust off and everything. I'm just not sold at all.
Sure. I don't blame you for that, but also like just at the bottom of these lists, this list and everyone else's list, I'm sure it's so like blah kind of like there's just mm-hmm. like once you get past a certain point, like you could put almost anyone in that bottom tier, and I wouldn't really bat an eye at it, just because of how just it's hard to find people to put there.
And related, I guess, to Humphreys is Thomas Zupacki and where we all put him. And I don't know about you guys, but I had a hard time figuring out what to do with him. Was it kind of more cut and dry? Yeah.
So. How I basically tried to approach from like below Vientos, where sort of the upside isn't as big. I basically thought who's going to pitch in the big leagues in the next year and a half or so. And so that was David Peterson and then, Zupacki and Killamay, assume, you know, with all the post TJ, you know, caveats that we do with guys like Franklin Killamay. But so yeah, I kind of figured that there might not be a ton of upside because they're both almost definitely relievers, and you know, the early returns off of Tommy John weren't great for Sapucki, and the track record in the system isn't good. You know, for Killamay, I guess we'll see, but the track record isn't good.
Yeah,
At least they're both going to pitch in the big leagues relatively soon.
Yeah, I put Sapucki 10 and Killamay 11, and I was flopping them around a bit. And the only reason why I put it that way was we didn't see Killamay last year, and we saw Sapucki last year. So,
yep.
Like, literally, that's the only reason why. Otherwise, if it was the roles were reversed, I would have switched them. It's both of them are kind of the same for me, at least. Which funny because they're different pitchers, but like,
I also think just lefties pitch forever.
Yeah, he'll find a way to have a MLB career just because he's left-handed.
And yep,
worked for plenty of other guys. So,
yep.
Ken, you were the only one of us that had Steven Gonsalves, so would you like to?
Yeah, he's going to pitch in the big leagues, and I like him more than, you know, Riley Gilliam.
Had him at 22. Okay,
yeah.
Yeah, again.
Yep.
we probably had Walker Lockett at somewhere around there, right?
Probably. No.
Like, a guy who's going to pitch in the big leagues is better than, you know, a guy who isn't, I guess.
Where is Gonsalves, you think, on the starting depth chart?
It's got to be like 6 or 7, right?
I don't know. I mean, once you get to the guys in the minors, it kind of gets very
I think he's probably above Peterson just because hasn't he been there before, Gonsalves?
Yeah, he does have a couple of starts worth of experience with Minnesota,
I think. Yes.
He was from, yeah.
That's where they claimed him from. He's definitely played in the majors, but I don't know, like, long.
Yeah, he was a weird case for me. I didn't really know what to make of him because he's a little bit older. I think he's like 25.
He's also never really been good.
Yeah, like he has. He's the kind of guy that has stuff that's like, you know, put up good numbers in the minors, which he did, and then probably he's going to get batted around in the majors, which he kind of did. I mean, it was a very small sample size for him in the majors, but still. And then, of course, he was injured and missed, I don't know if it was all or most of last season off the top of my head, but it was kind of like a weird profile for me to kind of, you know, where do I fit him in? And the fact that literally the Mets just kind of grabbed him, kind of an under-the-radar move at the after the year ended. Not much fanfare or anything like that. So, you know, you could if you have a guy like that and he's hyped up, I think that will color our perceptions a bit. Lucas had Scott Oda as his 25. I know that he's a fan of Oda, just based on like the one tool, and at that low on the list, it is kind of a situation where you're just looking at like one specific tool or so. I know when I put Jake Mangum at the list at 21, and Thomas, you had him at 22 also. I think I was just looking again at just tools, and he is a plus defender, so a plus defense tool and plus speed tool. That was at least my rationale.
I'm completely in agreement with you.
Mm-hmm.
It's at that, when you're that low, and I had Jalen Palmer at 21 because of the speed, and like, he's also super young, but like, I feel like once you're at that level, at that so low in the system that, oh, a guy could play defense, yes, you could make my list, because the tools we that could give him a little bit of a professional floor, because he'll have a floor up until like double A, and then whatever happens after that is up to his bat.
And they're not really that great of a bat, unfortunately.
No, it's not, but.
Let's see. Thomas, you also have Will Toffey as your 24 and Quinn Brody as your 25.
Yep.
You'd like to explain those?
They're not good, but when I was at so low in the, when I was thinking so low in, on this list, I was trying to think of people who could possibly pop, and I think those two people are like very outside cases to do so, if that makes sense.
I can see Brody having, you know, the bat with the power kind of. He does play a solid center field.
Yeah.
And there's a little bit of sneaky power. I could see him having a season where the power kind of shows up and you're just like, wow, Quinn Brody, where did this come from?
Exactly. Like, that's kind of what I was thinking. And I was just kind of, I was weighing a bunch of people for those late spots. And for me, Brody is someone who I liked his defense and he's hit a little bit, like not a lot, not a ton, but he's hit just a little bit where it's a little interesting where I want to see where it ends up. And yeah, that's basically it. Like, it's one of those things where the more I was thinking about the bottom of this list, the more it's so interchangeable.
Mm-hmm. When you think about it, Brody is like on the depth chart. If you ignore the just kind of, you know, veteran guys that are signed for injuries and whatever, Brody is at, like, scarily enough, like the top of the list of homegrown outfielders.
Yeah, I mean,
yeah, the outfield's been real thin for a real long time.
Honestly, I could think of only one other homegrown outfielder that would be ahead of Brody on the theoretical depth chart of guys. And it's Tim Tebow.
Oh, no.
Do you think he's ahead of Brody? Or do you think he's ahead of Brody because he's Tim Tebow?
A little of both. I don't think that his baseball skills are ahead of Brody's. I think that if Tebow wasn't injured and he didn't miss all that time last season, he definitely would be ahead of Brody in any kind of homegrown depth chart. But the fact that he kind of did miss time and obviously wasn't having the best season to begin with makes the lines a little more blurred. But
yep.
That is a frightening thought.
Yeah, like, the outfield depth is scarily thin. And it's something that it's kind of, like, gone under the radar this offseason. But, like, they're really close to having to call up some AAA players, and it's not good, like, mm-hmm. if they would have to do that.
And really, the AAA lineup in terms of outfielders is not looking too great either. I feel like last year they had a pretty decent amount of veteran outfielders.
Yeah.
Guys, Rajay Davis, a few guys that did get the call. But right now, as it stands, Syracuse's outfield is Ryan Cordell, Jashoni Fargas, Braxton Lee, Jarrett Parker, and Tim Tebow. And that's not really, yeah, if a Mets outfielder gets injured, it's not really an inspiring group of characters here.
They probably call up an infielder and, like, tell them to, like, tell someone to stand in left or right.
Yeah, I mean, that's I guess we'll get the J.D. Davis that's, in left.
That's or, the Mets way.
Yeah.
Well, I'm assuming J.D. Davis starts in left. Because, like, the fifth outfield is probably Dom.
That's true, that's true. So, then you'll have Dom in the outfield, which is...
Yeah.
But at the same time, I guess I have more faith in him than, you know, just Jashoni Fargas.
Well, yeah, because Dom could at least maybe hit his way out of his defense. And then they call up, like, Eduardo Nunez to fill the bench spot or whatever. Even though he has a real shot at making the 53, like I'm talking about football. The 25-man roster. Or is it 26 this year?
Will be 26. In any case, it's not not good.
Not great, Bob.
Did you guys have any just kind of stray observations about our individual lists?
Not really.
Yeah, it was a kind of, it's just, you know, it's a very tiered thing, like we were saying. That top tier, that top, you know, 1 to 6 or whatever, like, okay, it's the same name, just kind of different orders. Maybe there's another tier, like 7 to 15, if even. I don't know, maybe it's really more like 7 to 10, where it's guys that are just kind of outside the top. And then really, you know, 10 to 15, whatever, to the bottom, then it just was really preference. And that makes fun when you're just getting everybody's lists, and then you can say, like, you know, well, what is this guy thinking? Or I wonder what his thoughts are. But makes for a lot of very, very few unanimous decisions across the board. As opposed to years past when, you know, everybody had Noah Syndergaard 1, everybody had Travis d'Arnaud 2, or vice versa, whatever, you know. Those days are, you know, maybe next season that would be cool if everybody takes those very important steps forward. But unfortunately, these are the Mets, so always expect the worst. Yep. All right, well, if anyone has any comments or questions, whatever, you can send us an email at our email address from complextoqueens@gmail.com. You can follow us on Twitter and shoot us questions there. I'm at Steve Saipa. Ken is at KenLevin91. And Thomas is at SadMetSeasonSZN. And, of course, please subscribe to our podcast if you don't already do so. Rate and review it if you already haven't done so. And thank you for listening. And we will be back next week with some spring training news, I guess. And until then, love the Mets. Love the Mets.